By the time my dad met him, he had been in the Merchant Marine 55 years. Never been in a church in his entire life. When he retired at age 70, started the Merchant Marine at age 15, lied about his age, he marched into my dad's music store and he said, "I'm 70 years old. I would like to learn music." So he walked over to this organ that said Magic Fingers. Anyone can play. And he bought that organ from my dad for $6,000. All my dad had to do to demonstrate it was flip on a switch, press one finger down, and the rhythm starts gung chuka gung chuka gung, and little arpeggios and everything. And he one finger down, and he sounded like a musician. So this is exactly what he wanted. So he had my dad deliver that out to his mobile home in Trailer Park, where he was just about the only living man. And all the rest were little ladies. In the next 5 years, he bought five organs from my dad. He bought one every year. The last one he bought was $15,000, horseshoe-shaped, three manuals, double pedal, speakers the size of refrigerators. I am not joking. We had to dismantle the sliders on this guy's double wide to get that thing through the door. It was 110 degrees outside that day. And we're sweating like hogs by the time we got that in. Now, for the last 5 years of buying a new organ every year, this guy pestered my dad. The second organ he bought, he called my dad at 10 o'clock at night, sort of like your service calls, Bill. People don't think you have a life. They just know they don't have any hot water. Doug called my dad at home. Bob, blankety, 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 and he started cursing electricians. He started cursing, you know, people that, you know, manufacturing in America. He cursed everything he could think of, and he says, "I turned the on button and nothing happened." So my dad put his coat on over his jammies, drove across town, walked in. First thing he did is he noticed that it was unplugged. So he went over and he plugged it in. And Doug says, "Blankety blank blank, thank you, Bob, blankety blank." This happened for 5 years. This guy, you have to understand, my father was a very unusual man. I never once in my whole life saw my dad ever lose his temper. Never saw him speak harshly to anyone. Doug was the test. So the last organ that Doug bought in his life from my dad is this massive, something Phantom of the Opera should have, you know, been playing. And my dad and I moved it over there, took the sliders off, stuck it inside, put the sliders back on, and we're just dripping with sweat. And Doug walked out from the kitchen with three big ice-cold beer bottles and said, "Bob, blankety-blank, Bob Jr., blankety-blank, would you like a blankety-blank beer, blankety-blankety-blankety?" And my dad, I'm not joking, this guy could not do a sentence without 50 swear words in it. He was a very kind man. He just had no control. He had no sense of other people's boundaries at all. And Dad said, "No, we're good. We just like to sit in here where it's cool for just a minute, and then we'll be on our way." And Doug reached into his little nightstand, took out a notebook and a pen, and he said, "Bob, blankety, 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 I would like to ask you what you know, blankety, blank, about blankety, blankety, God." And my dad said, "What?" And I'm thinking, this is a trick. This is some kind of dirty joke, and I'm just waiting for the punchline. And he got very serious. I'll leave out the blankety, blanketies, but they were there. He said, "I'm 70 years old, 72 or 73 by that time. He said, I've never been to church in my whole life. He said, I just got back from the doctor. I found out I don't have as long to live as I thought I did. He said, I decided it's about time I started thinking about God. He said, I thought about everybody I knew. And did anybody know anything about God? And he said, you are the first person that came to my mind. He said, tell me about God. So I sat there, and my dad is totally stunned. This is the last thing in the world he expected. My dad gave him a really, really simple testimony of his own life. He invited him to church, which was a Saturday. It was the next day. Doug came the next day, gave his life to Jesus. The next Sunday, he brought three of the old ladies from his trailer park. By the time he was a Christian for a month, he'd led 20 or 30 people to the Lord. And most of them was they just couldn't believe that he was going to church. They couldn't believe it. 70 years, no Christian influence whatsoever. No tracts were involved, no theological arguments, no apologetics. My dad just lived the life of somebody that you'd have to know. My dad, he just lived and breathed Jesus constantly. Is it possible that somebody could be won over without words? Absolutely. I think I've got plenty of time. So I'm going to tell another story. Some of you have heard this story, but these people I think are in heaven now. When I knew them, they were in their late 60s. Jim was the man. Joanne was the wife. Jim had also been in the Merchant Marine, coincidentally. He, you know what? He loved his wife, but his wife's number one goal in her life for the 10 years that she'd been a Christian was to get her husband to church. And she did the thing that we do when we've tried the kind approach and it doesn't work. She tried pushing. She tried nagging. She did things I've never seen anybody do. She would take the covers off of his Western novels, take the covers off of Christian books about being a good husband, and she would switch the covers. Like, I don't know, he's going to be reading two chapters in and all of a sudden go, hey, wait a minute, this isn't Louis L'Amour. This is about being a Christian. You know what I mean? She would put tracks in his Sports Illustrated. Now, when I first met him, for some reason, he really liked me. We really hit it off. So three times a year they live in Hawaii. Three times a year when I went over there to minister for a couple of weeks at a time, they always had me stay with them. But I was leverage. She thought, here's a man that he likes, who's a Christian. And it was extremely uncomfortable because I watched what she was doing and I watched the way he was responding, and he was just like this, getting more and more and more. In fact, he was absolutely the kindest husband you can imagine until she started her nagging thing. And then he was getting harder and harder. One day I sat down and talked with her and I said, Joanne, she's 40 years older than me at this time, so I'm being very careful. I said, I don't think that it's working. What you're doing is not working. And I said, can I be frank with something that I see? I said, I don't think it's about Jim's salvation anymore. I think it's about you. And she started crying. She said, all my friends' husbands come to church with them, and they sit there and they hold hands and they go to the meetings. And she said, I'd give anything for that. And I'm the only one who doesn't have Christian. And you know what? And she was broken up. And I said, but it's not really about him. It's about you. It's about you having that Christian husband that everybody else has. And I said, I'd like to ask you to try something. You can take it or leave it. I said, I'd like to ask you to not speak to him anymore about coming to church with you. Stop putting tracks in his Sports Illustrated and just pray for him. And don't pray for him like he's your husband. Pray for him like he's a nice man named Jim who's going to go to hell. And stop thinking about him as your husband. And you know what? Bless her heart. She did. When you've been doing something for 10 years, it's hard to stop, even if it's not working. I came back, I think it was about 7 or 8 months later, and I flew in on a Saturday, and the next Sunday morning I was supposed to minister at their church called the Aloha Church, was the name of their church. And as I pulled up in the parking lot, Jim, first time I'd ever seen him not wearing flip-flops, a Hawaiian shirt and shorts. He was wearing a suit and a tie, and he was standing out in front of the door with a big pile of bulletins, and he's handing them to people. And when he saw me, he started calling them brother and sister and shaking their hands. And then we went, and he sat right in the front row with his wife and held her hand. And she just blubbered through the whole thing. She just sobbed and sobbed. And he kind of got teary-eyed. That afternoon, I went over to their house, and I said, Jim, buddy, let's go for a walk. And we went out, and we walked down the beach, and I said, so? And he said, what? And I said, no, so what happened? I see you're going to church. And instantly, tears came to his eyes. He started weeping openly. I'd never seen him show emotion like that. And all he could say was, I have the most wonderful wife in the world. And I said, yeah, but what happened? Yeah, she's great, but what happened? And he couldn't say anything else than that. I have the most wonderful wife in the world. So I gave up, and I went in and I talked to her. I said, hey, this is not the same guy. And she started crying. She says, I know. I said, what happened? She said, I did what you said. I stopped talking to him about coming to church. I stopped giving him tracts. I gave him his magazines back. I stopped trying to hide the naughty ones. And I just started praying for him that he would come to know Jesus. And she said, while I was doing that, praying for him, the Lord told me some things that I could do for him that I'd never done for him before. So she started doing stuff for him. She started doing little wifely things, which you're not very good at if you're nagging all the time. But since she had all that extra time, she said, after about a month of not inviting him to church, he started getting really worried. He wondered if I was having an affair, or he wondered if I was dying or something. He started getting really concerned. And finally, he came at the dinner table. He says, well, I'll go to church with you. And she said, are you sure? She said, I don't think I want you to come unless you're ready. And she did everything she could to not push him. First Sunday that he came, he heard the gospel. Thank God for Rod Kawakami, his pastor, who preached the gospel, and Doug gave his life to Jesus. See, 10 years of trying manipulation and all that junk never got her what it was that she wanted. And actually, all of her prayers weren't really about his salvation until that point. They were all about her. So, those are two examples I think of whenever I think of what Peter says here. I played a song on last night that was written by a friend of mine about this. It's called Silent Witness. You can Google it, see if you can find it, because I don't have a way to play it for you tonight. But it's a friend of mine who was led to the Lord by his wife becoming a Christian when their marriage was on the verge of divorce. And when she became a Christian, she completely changed. And after a few months of watching her life, he went with her to Calvary Chapel, gave his life to Jesus, and that was almost 40 years ago. And he's one of my favorite songwriters in the world. His name is Bob Ayala, if you ever get a chance to hear him. Best guitar player I've ever heard. Plays on Phil Kagi albums. Okay, where was I going with that? Peter says, so that even if they are obstinate and unreasonable and not paying attention to God's word, they could still be won over when they see the behavior of their wives. Is it possible? Absolutely. Is it guaranteed? No way. God doesn't violate people's free will. You can't manipulate somebody in, but it is possible. I think it goes back to what we looked at last week. It's possible, though not guaranteed, that even the most hard-hearted anti-Christian person can be won over by watching a life that's filled with the real Jesus. And even if it doesn't work, even if they get mean, Peter says in verse 15 of chapter 2, that's still God's way. That's God's way of dealing with it, is return good for evil. And so that's what he's saying here. Had you circled the word see, I sort of got into those stories, but those are real people. Those are real people who are all in heaven right now, by the way, that I just told you. The word see, Fred looked it up for me in his many Greek Bibles. I thought it was the same word that we looked at on Sunday about Jesus watching the way people were giving in the temple courts. It's not the same word, but it carries the same flavor. It means to watch someone closely or intently over a period of time. And I want to talk about this for a moment because this is where we blow it. Because this is not a word of immediate response. Remember, Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, let your light so shine before men that when they see your good works, they glorify your Father which is in heaven. It's the same flavor of word. When people watch the way you live your life intently over a period of time, they will notice. Here's what usually happens. When we don't get the immediate response, then we try to manipulate. You know what? If you're only doing something to get somebody to respond a certain way, that's hypocrisy, and God won't honor it. It's manipulation. Don't you hate when you're being manipulated? Man, I do. So does God, by the way. When they see the purity and reverence, verse 2 says, of their wives, moral purity is what that word means. And reverence is just somebody who has that right posture towards God. And then in verse 3, he starts talking about earthly beauty, exterior beauty. So don't throw all your energy into that external kind of beauty. And he gives a few examples. He gives the kind of examples you would expect from a fisherman who knows nothing about fashion or haute couture. I mean, this is the guy that was a fisherman. I've often wondered when I've read this passage, we know Peter was married. We know from Paul's letters that later on in Peter's life, he took his wife with him when he went to speak at different places. We saw the house they lived in, didn't we, in Capernaum. Beautiful little seaside place on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. I just wonder, he was a pretty hardcore dude. I wonder if when he's talking about the women who are beautiful from the inside out, I wonder if he's thinking of his wife. Don't know. I do know that he wanted her with him when he was going to talk about Jesus all over the then known world. That says something, doesn't it? So don't let it be with all those externals. Instead, verse 4, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty, the kind that doesn't go away. Which does the world emphasize? Well, in a culture like ours, it emphasizes the externals, and even though, I mean, science can only do so much, and gravity will eventually win. You know what I mean? And age will win. I mean, you can only cover it for so long, Joan Rivers notwithstanding. He said, don't put your energy into that because that does fade. Put your energy into the thing that doesn't fade. Let me read the Amplified Bible in verse 3 and 4. I love this. Let not yours be the merely external adorning with elaborate interweaving and knotting of the hair and the wearing of jewelry or change of clothes. Sounds like a fisherman, doesn't it? But let it be the inward adorning and the beauty of the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible and unfading charm of a gentle and peaceful spirit which is not anxious or wrought up but is very precious in the sight of God. Verse 4, let it be the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. Those are good words, gentle and quiet. The word gentle is one of two Greek words for gentle, adjectives. This is the horsemanship word, prautes, P-R-A-U-T-E-S. It's translated often in the King James Bible as meek. But it's a strong word. The reason it's a horsemanship word is because its roots come from the point at which a wild horse can be ridden by a child because of having been broken in and trained and saddled. So one translator, every time this word prautes appears, calls it strength under control. Means that that wild horse is still just as strong as he always was, only now he's not going to hurt anybody. Now that a little child can ride him. Peter said, that is extremely valuable quality to God. In a man or a woman, I think it may be even more valuable in a man because it's more natural to a woman than it is to a man. Does it remind you of anybody? Isn't it exactly like Jesus? Do you understand that is God's goal, whether you're a male or a female? God's goal is that the character and nature of Jesus, who is the model of the perfect human, would be formed in us. And the word quiet here in verse 4, it has nothing to do with the volume or the number of your words. I wrote down a couple of, I thought, interesting synonyms from the Greek dictionary. Unanxious, imperturbable. Say that 5 times real fast. Imperturbable, can't be shaken. The Amplified Bible says, not anxious or wrought up. Peter said, you know, if you're going to win somebody over, even if they're bullheaded and obstinate and they're not paying any attention to God's word, you be a person who's like Jesus. And there's a possibility, without even one word being spoken, toward changing their mind, they could be won over. That's Peter's intent. I think that's why it's such a hopeful scripture. You probably got your stories of people that you've seen God win over. You might even be one. You might even be one person who said, no stinking way am I ever going to go to church. You'll never catch me dead in the church. Well, maybe dead at my funeral. And here you are. You love Jesus. I can't emphasize this enough. I think if you're going to take seriously what he says in verse 1 and verse 7, this applies, and what he said back in chapter 2, this applies to all of us. And the way we live our lives in front of people who are hostile towards us. If they're going to be won over, it's not going to be because we're hostile back. It's not because we get the last word in, or we retaliate, or we have the perfect exegetical argument to demolish all of their... No, if there's a good chance of a heart being softened, and God knows when that's possible, it will be because we live the Jesus life in front of them. And Peter said, you know, all those holy women, the word holy means set apart for God, all those women heroes, he said, that's the kind of beauty they poured themselves into. We talked about last night how some of them were outwardly beautiful as well. Abigail and Esther and Sarah. Sarah was so beautiful that when she was in, last time I taught this, I said, when she was in her 90s, she was beautiful. And I thought, no, I don't mean that. I don't mean her sleepwear. I mean when she was over 90 years old. Not in her 90s. So people laughed the last time that I said that. She was so beautiful that Abraham was afraid that Abimelech was going to kill him and steal her. It's interesting that the women who were godly women were pouring their energy into being beautiful on the inside. And the outside was immaterial. George MacDonald said an interesting thing in one of his essays on what to look for if you're looking for a wife. He said, "You are better off if you find a homely woman who loves God, because she's going to get more and more beautiful the longer she lives." He said, "You're better off with that than finding a woman who's beautiful and doesn't love God, because she's going to get more homely the longer you know her." And I thought, that's profound. Someone needs to tell that to the advertising business, don't they? I had you underline in verse 5 the phrase, "put their hope in God." You know what the word hope means by now. It means the confident expectation of future good. It means what you are. It's a word of the not yet. It's a word of looking down the road, and I'm confident that this is going to turn out good. That's what the word hope means. Here's the interesting thing, and I think this applies to the example of my friend in Hawaii, who they're in heaven now. Much more beautiful than Hawaii. She transferred her hope from getting her husband to church onto her hope in God. And she said, "God, you know him better than I do. You love him more than I do. You know what to do. I'm placing all my hope in you, and I'm keeping my mitts off. It's off."